Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Alexander Vindman is a great American story. A Jewish emigre from Eastern Europe, he devoted much of his life to the service of our country and sacrificed a promising military career to do what he felt his oath required. In testifying against President Trump at his first impeachment trial, Vindman, then a director in the National Security Council at the White House, shone a spotlight on Trump's corrupt scheme in Ukraine. But it also cost Vindman a promising career. He retired as a lieutenant colonel. He tells his story in an inspiring new memoir, Here Right Matters, an American story. I sat down with Colonel Vindman this week to talk about that journey. Ironically, it was just before President Biden was to sit down with President Zelensky of Ukraine, a meeting that Vindman had hoped to arrange with President Trump 2 years ago that was at the core of the controversy on which he testified. Here's our conversation. Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, it's so good to see you. We've seen you, all of us have seen you from afar in your dress uniform before you retired, testifying before Congress in the impeachment trial. We will have a lot of time to talk about that, but first, welcome. And I want to talk about your extraordinary journey to that point and after.
Well, thank you for having me on, David. It's an honor. I've watched you from afar for decades, and appreciate your work, and glad to be on this program with you.
Thank you. As we were discussing before we started rolling, we have something in common in that both our families were Jewish emigres from the same part of the world, generations apart. But talk to me a little bit about your story that you wrote so beautifully about in your book, Here Right Matters, which you recently published. But you were born in Kiev. But talk to me about your family history there and what led your family to come here.
Sure. So it is amazing how many people I've run across with either recent or deep roots in that part of the world. I think one thing that we all kind of shared in common was a recognition that the same opportunities that we are able to enjoy here were not available there in different ways. I think it seems that with the earlier generations, it was more direct physical threats and harm, pogroms and so forth. And mm-hmm. then with more recent generations, it was the lack of access to prosperity, lack of equality. In my case, that was a driving force for my father to make sure that we could enjoy at least the same kinds of benefits that he was able to through focus and willpower achieve in his life.
He and his family, long before you came along, you and your twin brother and your older brother, they faced all kinds of hardship and deprivation. And
it's pretty amazing. It's to me, it is something that is hard to understand. Growing up in the States and not having to face those kinds of challenges, we see it with the Afghan refugees coming into the country now. They have a whole different coming to the United States experience or a different context for what difficulties are really like. We don't get to experience that as Americans. My father was born in 1932. He was a very young man when the Second World War started. His father was killed in action, but not before he was able to warn my grandmother, my dad's mom, that the Nazis were coming. Time to flee Kiev. And if he had not made that warning, It's possible that my family, I would have never existed. My family could have been one of those more than 33,000 Jews that were killed in the Babin Yar massacre. Mm-hmm. But he ended up fleeing to the Ural Mountains. Russia is a massive piece of territory, thousands of miles away from the front, and surviving the war there and then being part of that rebuilding process that the Soviet Union undertook in the post-war period, you know, with the entire western portions of the country completely decimated and building from scratch. And he built a life for himself. He didn't leave until he was 47, and we were toddlers at that point, bringing us to the United States. So he had restarted his life multiple times. I think that's part of my legacy. And I think that's something that stayed with me in my recognition that if I couldn't do what I wanted to, if I didn't have the same opportunities in the military, it was totally fine for me to start over.
Yeah, no, that's a through line in your book. You write about the fact that he was an engineer, was very much a part of the apparatus in Kiev. What persuaded him that he had to go? He obviously faced anti-Semitism.
I think there were two key factors. One was the fact that my biological mother, was dying of cancer, and he had learned of Reza Shah being treated in the United States for his lymphoma, his cancer. And he thought that there was a reasonable chance of making it over to the United States and saving my mother, saving his wife. So that was one of the driving forces.
Let's just stop for a second there. Yeah. We should point out that your book begins with, you know, really kind of searing memories of you and your brother being at a facility, basically, where you were sent while your mother was dying. How did the loss of your mom, the absence of her, I guess, is more, how did that affect the two of you?
I think in a lot of ways, and it's a different experience than my older brother, who's 7 years older, who had a chance to know her. We didn't get a chance to know her. And our relationship with our father is that much stronger because he had been a central figure in our life. We didn't have both a mother and a father in those early formative years. Our father has always been, my father remarried. My stepmother is a terrific, wonderful woman. But I think in certain ways, our dad's been kind of a central figure, very loving, doting and stuff like that, affectionate, even though he's a tough guy to everybody else. He's been very close and instrumental in giving us our first dose of character and work ethic and determination. And we recognize him for that. We love him and recognize him.
Yeah, you know, you're right about the fact that when you came to New York, the Hebrew Immigrant Society advised maybe he should think about putting you two up for adoption just to relieve the burden on himself, and he would hear none of that.
Yes, I think that's right. It's interesting for me to think about my dad, who, again, you know, is there's a sense of machismo that I think runs through, you know, Soviet men, you know, Ukrainian or Russian men, that doesn't necessarily allow them to kind of form that what I would think would be a completely healthy, loving relationship with their children, especially you want to raise your sons to be tough. And he was disciplinarian. He was, you know, he was firm with us when he needed to be, but he was also very affectionate. And I think possibly that was probably because of the loss of his wife, our mother, that all that love that would have, you know, been dispersed amongst a kind of a larger family was focused on his kids.
I read in your book that you, when you went back in, I guess, 2019 to Ukraine, that you visited your mother's gravesite. How was that experience?
You know, I just came back from a research trip to Ukraine and working on my doctorate. And every time I'm there, I see it as an obligation to visit my mother and visit my grandmother, my dad's mom, who I'd never met, actually. And you know, at least because we have no family there, clean up the gravesite, make sure that it's in good repair, and in some way ensure that their memory is not forgotten. You know, mm-hmm. that somebody cares about these people that the rest of their family is thousands of miles away. So I made it a point, you know, on my trip to for the Zelensky inauguration, previous trips to Ukraine, to always kind of make it a stop and make sure things were in good shape. And it's some sort of connection. I guess it's the only real connection we have to that part of the world. We grew up here only in the U.S., only knowing America. But there's a connection to Ukraine in that our families are, you know, our parents are, my mom's buried there, our ancestors are buried there, and those are where our roots are. Maybe that in part kind of shaped my keen focus on the region and adds to my understanding of Ukraine and the importance of Ukraine.
You mentioned refugees from Afghanistan. The U.S. essentially opened its arms to Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe in the late 70s, early 80s, and you came in that migration. How do you feel these Afghan refugees are going to be received now? And as you know, you served in a White House that was discouraging of any kind of immigration, including refugees. So what do you think the environment is that these folks will meet as compared to what you and your family saw?
I'll be a little less democratic. I'd say they're nativist and hateful towards non-white Americans. I mean, that's just a simple fact. I am concerned about it, about the fact that they might not get a warm reception and that society is very polarized. It has been polarized in the past. We know, you know, as students of history, that German populations, Irish populations, Italian populations were reviled when there were surges of immigrants at those periods of time. And it's unfortunate that, you know, a lot of Americans forget the hardships that their predecessors had to encounter. I know when I was walking through the airport, it just really warmed my heart to see all those folks. They're still in shock, you know, moving with probably in the same way that we did, with just a handful of luggage and started from scratch. And I just try to give them, even with a mask on, try to give them kind of, you know, a warm smile or something like that to make them feel welcome. Because in reality, we should be grateful for them coming here. We should be grateful for them willing to add their strength to our strength to make this country, you know, adding some maybe 100,000 more Americans that want to join the American dream, want to be part of this country, willing to give up everything to join this country, and ultimately adding to the greatness of this country in the long term. And I'm grateful for that.
As I said, I'm a son of an immigrant, and proud of that, and proud of the contributions that collectively immigrants have made to build this country. But more than that, it feels like we have a special obligation here. And that leads me to a question. And tell me what your thoughts were. I was struck in your book, by the way, that you did your exit interview at the Pentagon with General McKenzie, who everybody watched this week describe the operation that he oversaw of evacuation. Tell me what your thoughts were this week about this.
I had deeply mixed feelings as things unfolded, you know, over the preceding several weeks, about some introspective questions about whether it was worth it, whether the blood and treasure spilled was worth it. And we spent an enormous amount of blood and treasure on a conflict that seemingly didn't do anything for U.S. national security. But I think that's a very superficial take. I think, in fact, there are several different layers that absolutely merit some sort of attention. First of all, for 20 years, we provided a respite for an Afghan population that had no taste of what freedom, democracy was like. I think to me that is, you know, if you could do that for millions of people, that is pretty amazing service. Did it directly contribute to U.S. national security? Maybe not. But for humanity, we provided a service, and the same kind of service that the U.S. has taken on as a mantle for generations. The other thing we did was we kept the enemy at bay. We fought Al-Qaeda. We fought ISIS on distant shores, although it's ISIS-K, obviously, kept the homeland safe. I think, unfortunately, the execution of the drawdown necessitates two lessons. One is it probably could have been done better. It could have been executed better. There should have been better contingencies. A lot of that blame falls on the Department of Defense, I think, which is well known for developing, you know, contingencies that they failed to do so. And the other thing is that, in fact, I think it adds weight to President Biden's decision to withdraw. The fact that the Afghan government, the Afghan military fell apart within days, to me, suggests that another year, another 5 years would not be the tipping point. It would be just basically putting in blood and treasure. We didn't suffer any casualties over the past year, mainly because we had a negotiated agreement with the Taliban that they wouldn't attack us. If we broke that agreement, we would have victims, and we'd have to deal with more American spilled blood. But to me, it kind of justifies President Biden's courageous decision to get out. My only divergence on this point is that it could have been the withdrawal could have been managed a lot better. It could have been managed so that we withdrew all of the people that we thought we needed to, that supported us over the previous 20 years, without the kind of the humanitarian disaster. But other than that, to me, what this does is frees up enormous bandwidth to deal with other challenges that directly press on U.S. national security interests.
I agree with your analysis, and I heard Joe Biden make it in the Situation Room 12 years ago that we were going to get sucked into an endless conflict if we made counterinsurgency rather than counterterrorism our focus. But the people who would argue otherwise would say that that taste of freedom that the people of Afghanistan got has now been wrenched away from them as the Taliban returned. So, and therefore, we should have stayed in order to preserve that opportunity for them.
I think, David, I think that's there are always calculations to be made based on interests and values. I that's the way I couch how we should consider our national security, how we should consider our foreign policy. There should be a measured analysis of interests and values. And yes, there's a values-based reason to stay in Afghanistan, maybe indefinitely. But from an interest perspective, we have other obligations, other considerations where we might need to be a little bit more thoughtful on our the application of our limited resources. It seems to me that if we wanted to take on this role of a purely humanitarian role of stepping into all sorts of conflicts in the world, we would run ourselves very, very thin. As a student of, you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union, one of the things that challenged the Soviet Union is that they were spread so thin across the globe, trying to precipitate revolutions and communist uprisings. We're a completely different scale, you know, much more prosperous, much more a capable country. But we also probably need to focus our resources on challenges, both internal and external. To me, part of my thesis for my doctoral work is that it's because of the laser focus on the global war on terror that we failed to really notice the rise of a much more aggressive Russia and China, and that they, in turn, accepted that the U.S. was not concerned about nation-state actors. They were concerned about global war on terror and acted to upend international norms. I would also, just on the Afghanistan point, I'd just like to close this point because I know there's a lot that we want to cover, is that the Taliban, it's one thing for the Taliban to seize terrain, you know, and occupy Afghanistan. It's a whole different story for them to try to rule. The 20 years of the taste of freedom we've already seen that kind of in terms of the way the population's responded to Taliban crackdowns. It is not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy for some 75 or 100,000 Taliban to control a population of 38 million that has an expectation for a different kind of life. And the Taliban's actually, in fact, different. At least the Taliban leadership, they've been based out of Doha for a decade. And they understand, you know, what prosperity could be like. They want to preserve some of that prosperity for themselves and their clans and the tribal elite, at least. I think it's a different country than it was 20 years ago. We left an indelible mark on it. And right now the pendulum has swung very far over to Taliban control over the country, but the population hasn't actually voiced its own, considered thinking on where it wants the country to go to. So we're only seeing things unfold right now.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. You grew up in Brighton Beach in Brooklyn, and you really grew up in an enclave of emigres from Eastern Europe, Jewish emigres from Eastern Europe. What, tell me about that, what that was like.
You know, it's interesting. My father made it a point to extract us from that enclave relatively quickly. You know, we could have grown up like to be Lev Parnassus or something like that, frankly, who basically was saturated in that kind of mindset.
We should point out, for those who don't remember, he was one of the characters who was an operative with Rudy Giuliani in the schemes that led to your...
To be fair, he's reformed. He seems to be reformed and, vehement anti-Trumper, which is good. We'll take everybody we can for our team. but at the same time, my dad wanted to make it a point that he wanted us to kind of acculturate, immerse in American society, not just the Russian immigrant society of Brighton Beach. So we were there for about a year and a half, and then we moved. We might as well have moved into a different world because we moved neighborhoods in Brooklyn, and we moved from that neighborhood to a neighborhood that was, between a new Asian population that was emerging, a Chinese population, Hispanic population, established Italian population, an Orthodox Jewish population. And that's kind of where we spent probably the last 10 years before going off to university.
Your family struggled, as immigrant families do. Your dad, who had, a professional training, started off as working in a furniture store, moving heavy furniture, and then became a civil servant and worked on water projects in New York City. But there was a period that was really hard for you guys.
It is a period that's really hard. And I'm mindful of the our new future Afghans, Americans coming here and having some immense challenges. We had a combination of, some limited support. My dad refused to take, he makes it a point to say he was never on welfare. He refused to take handouts. But in fact, that may have been his mentality, and he was able to cope with that. I think this is a group of people that's going to need some help. It's a culture change. It's a shocking change in the span of a short period of time. They didn't have a chance to make any kind of either the mental or the preparatory adjustments to thrive in American society. And I hope we are welcoming and help those folks, help them join American society. If not for themselves, for their children and for the future generations to be in the best shape possible to contribute to this country. My dad's, maybe this is a formula for success for those new folks coming in. He had 2,000 index cards, and he basically memorized the words on those 2,000 index cards and tried to string them together in like semi-coherent sentences. And that was sufficient for him to pass the civil service exam, and which is technical, and join professional society.
The way you describe it, I think this is not unfair. You and your twin brother were a couple of knuckleheads running around New York in the day, doing crazy things, jumping off of stuff, and getting into mischief.
Yes.
You weren't a scholar was not a word that would attach to you back then.
I would say I was ill-disciplined and unfocused. Some combination of the two of, not the educational system not quite serving us, and then us not being internally driven on our own. And I think the internal drive is actually probably the more important factor. But in those early years, we were, looking for ways to get our energy out and, active and running around. We weren't like criminals or anything. We were maybe a little bit, we were kind of, a little bit of hooligans.
But you did carry some of those bad habits of about scholarship to your first experience with college at American University. Part of it was that you went into the ROTC. You were very focused on that, wanted to get your Ranger badge and so on. But you kind of bombed out there.
We were both, my twin brother and I were both kind of late bloomers. And maybe what we didn't have is we, in a lot of ways, had it a lot easier than my father growing up. And, you know, we didn't have to, we didn't really quite understand the consequences of our actions, I would say, simply put. Because of that, we didn't realize that, you know, being non-studious, being unfocused was going to have some baggage along with it. What in my case, that ended up, you know, I was suspended from American University. I took a semester off, and then I had a chance to reflect on, okay, what can I actually do? Can I achieve any of my goals if I continue on this way? And with that bit of introspection, I realized I couldn't, and I went back to State University of New York at Binghamton, and frankly finished up with a better GPA than all the rest of my brothers, which is good.
But who's counting, right?
Who's counting? That's right. Yeah. And then from there, you know, giving myself a foundation to enter military service, and then start the project of improving myself, building the good habits, becoming more disciplined, and building on probably what was already a pretty strong kind of ethical foundation, if not all the best character traits, all those things slowly coming together through public service. And that's why I'm such a huge advocate for public services, that for me, public service was, you know, kind of a lifesaver. Maybe that's a little bit of an overstatement, but I benefited immensely. I, you know, all those things that allowed me to get to the White House and serve this country originated with public service and military service. So I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very clear as you describe your evolution in this book that your years in the military, which is a lot of your life, but those early years were formative for you. You spent 18 months in Korea. I was wondering, by the way, when I read that, you also were in and around the White House when President Trump had his bromance with Kim Jong-un. And I was wondering how you processed that as someone who had spent 18 months over there and had observed North Korea from across a very tight border there. What were your thoughts then?
There are two tendencies that I've distilled for Trump. One is to poke, is to basically kind of like irritate, to troll. He loves to do that. You know, if somebody says no, he's going to do the opposite. Or if somebody says that's not a good thing to do, he's going to do the opposite. The other thing is, you know, a overarching desire for self-service. And, you know, whether that's, in that case, being a peacemaker, so he could be, you know, get a Nobel or something of that nature, or with regards to even his bromance with Vladimir Putin, part of that is to dispel any notions of unfair 2016 elections that the Russians, all of these things. I mean, there was a underlying logic to a lot of his actions with regards to authoritarian leaders. And then the third component, which is not negligible, is that he wishes he was like them. He wishes he had that kind of power. He wishes he had that kind of authority. He wishes that he had that kind of, he could command that kind of respect. And he couldn't. I mean, he was his own worst enemy, half measures with regards to his engagement with South Korea. Same thing with regards to, with regards to Russia, with regards to the Chinese relationship and trying to push back on Chinese economic coercion and all of the things that we've experienced with regards to China, intellectual property theft, the militarization of South China, East China Seas, all these things he wasn't able to effectively manage. Even though the defense apparatus, the national security apparatus was trying to implement his strategy, but it's the president's own involvement that tended to upend, you know, the successful conclusion of these enterprises.
Yeah.
He just couldn't manage him.
Did you think his flirtation with Kim Jong-un was, I mean, as you spoke in the councils of the NSA, did you guys look at each other and say, this is nuts?
Well, there's a way to rationalize some of these things, frankly, from a national security foreign policy perspective. If you recall, there was a march towards conflict with North Korea. And at minimum, if this was done properly, you could ease up on the potential for outright military conflict. So that could be rationalized. But what you can't necessarily rationalize is the fact that the president sacrificed making progress on denuclearizing Crimea, basically mortgaging a security in the Korean Peninsula for what amounted to a photo op. Mm-hmm. You know, so if he had done this successfully, he could have traded engagement with North Korea for something tangible, but he didn't.
He gave Kim Jong-un the thing he most wanted, which was that photo op, that sort of recognition of legitimacy, and got very little in return for it. He made an agreement with the Taliban in 2020, released 5,000 prisoners, agreed to an exit date in exchange for, and he did get something, which was they agreed not to shoot at American, fire on American troops during the period in which he was withdrawing, but could have driven a harder bargain, clearly.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
By the way, did you see today that the Republican caucus in Congress in the House is being advised by your old boss, O'Brien, who was your national security advisor, your last national security advisor, who presided over the negotiations with the Taliban in some form or fashion as the NSA.
Yeah.
Kind of ironic.
You know, it's interesting. O'Brien is not a credible figure. I'll tell you that your NSAs typically are very skilled, experienced individuals. Bolton, whether you like him or not, had a wealth of government experience.
He
was a hawk, but he knew his craft. He knew how to function. O'Brien's claim to fame was that he freed ASAP Rocky from the Swedes. That's how he got that job. I mean, he had no business in that role. He was not competent, and frankly, he was a marginal actor. He was there as kind of a placeholder because you needed somebody in that seat. But what it did was basically empowered Secretary Pompeo to in a lot of ways ride roughshod over the rest of the national security apparatus as it ran out of the White House. So it's hard for me to take anything that O'Brien says seriously.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy that he's now the principal advisor to Kevin McCarthy and the House Republicans on this issue, which he apparently is.
David, I just want to say something. There's a strange DC phenomenon that ex-officials, no matter from what administration, because of the title that they held, are somehow kind of still imagined as competent, as warranting those positions. That to me doesn't make sense. And part of this is a media establishment that wants to get somebody on to be able to provide commentary and invites these folks on. These people should not be considered serious national security experts in any way, shape, or form. So, that's just a little kvetch, I guess.
Yeah, kvetch way. That's part podcasting, man. You can do that. You served in Iraq. You were wounded in Iraq. Tell me what you took away from that experience.
Yeah, I think fundamentally, I guess there were probably two things. One is that I'm trainable. Some people, especially in my earlier years, would have thought that I'm not trainable. I'm incorrigible, but I was able to learn my craft and respond in a cool, calm, collected manner under fire. So that was the first thing. And that's always a question in your mind, when you're in that kind of situation, how do you respond? And I was, I was happy that I responded the way I would have liked to. So that's something. The other thing I learned is maybe a deeper sense of how the regional, how national, how kind of broader issues impacted on, just even a tactical situation. The improvised explosive device that punctured through our armored vehicle was designed, engineered by the Iranians. So there was already kind of like a little regional political understanding. And that's not something that as a young captain that you necessarily think of, you know, what's occurring at the operational strategic level. So I started to kind of expand my aperture on other things that were important. And it was the foundation in a lot of ways for becoming a foreign area officer in the Army and, you know, studying, understanding all of the inputs to foreign policy and national security.
This is hugely important because this was the sort of hinge moment in your career when you became a foreign area officer. Foreign area officers are experts in political military operations in specific regions of the world. And you had a leg up in a sense because you had some sort of language familiarity, but also other familiarity with Russia and Eastern Europe. And you were assigned to Russia as a foreign area officer. Yeah. Tell me about that experience and how that informed what you saw moving forward.
So first of all, I mean, I had a very amazing military career, both as an infantryman, serving in some of the best military formations under the best military leaders. And then as a foreign area officer, I had a pretty much an unprecedented run. I went to Harvard for graduate school. Not only did I already have Russian in my background, some of it self-taught, some of it perfected at Harvard. I also picked up Ukrainian, which is one of the reasons I ended up in my position at the NSC. And then my first assignment out the gate was to Russia for 2 years. I extended for 3 years. This is during a time where the relationship was in the beginning relatively normal. I mean, there's nothing normal about a relationship with Russia, but it was kind of a bilateral relationship. And then it went to a complete kind of basket case as the Russians invaded Ukraine. And I was on the ground watching the Russians implement hybrid warfare, watching convoys cross the border into Ukraine and reporting on those as an attaché. And having that firsthand experience, being asked to join the Pentagon and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs Staff as his Russian affairs officer. There, I drafted the most critical documents, pivoting us away from the global war on terror to nation state competition. So I drafted the National Military Strategy Russia Annex and the Global Campaign Plan for Russia, and then came to the attention of the White House that wanted to better manage our adversarial relationship with Russia. And it was almost kind of a straight line from foreign area officer through these developmental positions mm-hmm. to Russia, to the Pentagon, to the White House.
Let me ask you, though, you were in the Pentagon during the 2016 election.
Yes.
How aware were you? What was your level of awareness of the Russian operations in the U.S.?
It was about as high as you can get, I guess. Mm-hmm. I didn't have, let's say, all the access I had at the that I had at the White House, which was everything, but I had quite a bit, and I had a very good idea of what the Russians were doing in the United States.
And did it give you any pause when you got the offer to go over to the White House, which was, I guess, after Trump was elected in 2017? No. Did it give you any pause, especially given the portfolio that you were going to assume over there, to know that the Russians were sort of actively involved in that election, and whether with his, you know, I'm sure we can still get a debate mm-hmm. about what the level of the campaign's involvement with sure. the Russians were, but the Russians were clearly engaged on his behalf.
Sure.
Did any of that give you pause? Did you say, you know, this feels like it could be problematical?
It did. I went through I would say an exhaustive amount of deliberation, including talking to folks in the White House on McMaster's, the National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster's team, about what I would be stepping into. But I also recognized maybe I was the best positioned to have a positive influence on U.S. National security and foreign policy with regards to Ukraine. Since I was the one that was had authored these documents, understood what the Russians were doing, understood how, you know, they were operating in Ukraine, I thought that it would be a disservice, you know, to not contribute my capabilities and knowledge to help navigate an administration that didn't necessarily have the understanding of the Russian threat. And that's really, frankly, why I went in there. I mean, I went in there recognizing that it would be perilous. I also, somewhere in the back of my mind, knew that, you know, there would be certain lines that I wouldn't cross, But as long as the orders were lawful, I would have to obey them, providing the best, very best advice I could offer to the National Security Council, to the White House, on what we should be doing with Russia.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show.
You were there when, I think you had just arrived maybe, when President Trump met with Vladimir Putin in Helsinki and famously stood at a press conference and when was asked about the 2016 election, said Putin told me that they didn't have anything to do with it and I don't know why they would have, basically siding against all of the intelligence community and all the evidence that spoke to the opposite. What were your thoughts then?
Yeah, so that was my first day on the job. I mean, in a way, I wish that Fiona had joked about this. I wish that she had, pretended a fainting spell to interrupt that press conference that she had joked on a couple of occasions. But it was my first day on the job. I was just stepping in, doing all that kind of in-processing things that you do, getting your badges and all that kind of stuff, and stepped out of all these indoctrination meetings to listen to this press conference because it was important. And then the rest of the day was upended, and I think I had a pretty darn good understanding that, you know, as much doubt as I had about being able to sufficiently advise this administration, it was going to be even more an uphill battle.
Yeah. Well, let me put it bluntly. Did you go home to your heroic wife, Rachel, and say, holy shit, what have I done?
I think there may have been a moment like that. I think certainly Dr. Fiona Hill.
Fiona Hill, yes.
Coming back from that meeting, she asked me to pick up Ukraine also. And it's because she realized that there wasn't going to be as much as we would want to do to push back on Russian aggression, Russians' interference in U.S. domestic affairs. And I had talked through this idea of if we couldn't do it, with regards to our bilateral relationship with Russia, we could do it by hardening the countries around Russia's periphery. And I was happy to pick up Ukraine, which, that was a fateful step, I guess, putting me on a collision course with history and Trump and his machinations.
This story is well known. It's well told in your book, and I recommend people read it. But it's a little bit like a TV detective story. These pieces started coming into place. Rudy Giuliani emerges in Ukraine, of all places. He starts trying to besmirch the ambassador there, Yovanovitch, who you were close to and who you respected. And then president started balking at
the value of Ukraine as a partner.
Yeah. And even with the election of a new president, Zelensky, who represented some hope for that country. It all culminated in this call on July 25th of 2019. Talk very briefly about that moment, about yep. that call, about how that crystallized all these pieces, about how the picture filled in for you.
You know, as you pointed out very well, that this unfolded over the course of months. And really, the only thing that was missing by the 25th was whether the president was directly involved. I had heard, I had received reports that the president was involved. Certainly, Mick Mulvaney was a driving force. He was the president. He was one of your, that he was, Mick Mulvaney was helping orchestrate this White House meeting in exchange for a investigation into the Biden's drug deal. And the only thing that was missing, and what my reverence for the office of the president was, I was unwilling to accept it until I heard it with my own ears, was the fact that the president was the driving force. It was the president that was demanding this investigation into the Bidens, because he rightly assessed that Joe Biden would be his biggest adversary and would ultimately defeat him. He was looking for any advantage he could going into the 2020 elections. And that's what he settled on, is a way to steal the elections, upend free and fair elections.
Let me just ask you about this. You know, you said earlier that Trump, in certain ways idolized these authoritarian leaders. A lot of us have been concerned about, less about policy, although you can have policy disagreements, but about the kind of erosion of fundamental democratic pillars here. What have you seen in that episode and other episodes subsequent to that that give you concerns about America, you know, having watched the example of authoritarian countries and how they operate?
Yes, this is a well-established doctrine from a lot of it actually originating from the Soviet Union that the Russians continued to hone and implement. I mean, one of the examples is this idea of casting a doubt over the fact that there is an absolute truth, that there are facts, and that, you know, based on facts, you could draw kind of legitimate conclusions. The Russians have been masterful at undermining truth narratives. We've seen it play out historically with regards to for instance, AIDS originated. They claimed that it developed at a U.S. lab. We've seen it play out with regards to, you know, a Russian and Soviet era atrocities. And it's interesting that our own political leadership, you know, from the right at the moment, I don't see this being an issue from the left, but from the right, has latched onto these things and has basically adopted an authoritarian toolkit.
You went to your brother, who was a lawyer at the NSC in the White House, for advice when you heard the president ask Zelensky to open investigations into the Bidens. This was at a time when the Ukrainians were desperately wanting the U.S. to fulfill its obligation to provide, I think, $400 million in military aid that they needed to fight the Russians. And it seemed clear to you that there was a quid pro quo being set up at that moment. Did you know when you went and spoke to your brother and you decided that you needed to report this conversation, what you were opening yourself up to?
I certainly recognized that this was a vindictive administration and that there would be a significant risk to my being able to continue on at the White House. But I don't know if I fully kind of understood, because I was doing it behind closed doors in official channels, that I was going to kind of, you know, completely imperil my military career. That's something that I didn't quite realize. One point to your, you know, to the Russian tradecraft. The Russians, if you recall, in 2014, with regards to Ukraine, they injected this idea of illegitimate government, illegitimate elections. They did it, you know, months before the Ukrainians conducted their elections. This is the same thing that the president had done as early as the middle of 2020, even before, claiming that the election is going to be stolen. I don't know how that works, because he was in power. He was the executive branch. You know, how the Democrats were going to steal it when he was in power, but he was injecting that just so like this he could try to steal it when he didn't have, you know, the requisite of,
well, he followed the, you know, the deep state narrative that there was this deep state that was,
and then the insurrection to, of course he was willing to go as far as to propel an insurrection, violence on the streets to retain power.
You called him a useful idiot for Putin. Do you believe that there are ties between Trump and Russia?
It's ties. You know,
there's always been talk about real estate, and
there potentially can be ties. I'm not privy to that. It could seem, you know, based on who President Trump was, it's quite possible. But what I think is telling is that the Russians are just wouldn't manage him as a winning asset. They just wouldn't do that, because the potential for the president to kind of spout off at some point saying, "Oh, I'm only doing this because the Russians have me blackmailed," would be something that would be an enormous risk and blow up right in their face. So the reason I describe him as a useful idiot is that they didn't even have to really work that hard. They didn't have to pay him off. They didn't have to entice him with like other things. All they had to do was pander to his ego, you know, pander to his vanity, and you know, tell him how good looking he was, how competent he was, how everybody's against him. And that's how they got him to do what he needed to. And that's why it's a classic useful idiot.
Were you surprised at the fact that Trump was acquitted in that impeachment trial? And you seem both wounded and surprised in your writing that, you know, your promotion in the military, that your military career essentially was ended because of sensitivity on the part of the Pentagon about your profile and how it might be, how Trump sure. might react and other Republicans might react.
So with regards to his acquittal, it was not a surprise. I'd still kind of had this ideological or not idealistic rather hope that the Senate would do the right thing, but they didn't. They abrogated their responsibility as per pattern where the party in the executive branch has never been voted out of voted against in these types of events. So there was no chance. But the consequence of that was a mismanagement of COVID. So the president was emboldened going to COVID, economic catastrophe mismanaged, and then attempted stolen election in which on a second impeachment, again, the Senate failed to hold him accountable. So to me, the responsibility doesn't just fall on the president as a bad actor. It falls on the Senate failing to do their job, what we pay for. With regards to my own military career, yes, I was disappointed with regards to the military.
I mean, let me just interrupt you and say that what part of the consequences for you is 2 days after the president was acquitted, you were escorted out of the White House in a kind of weird sort of perp walky sort of way. The thing that I found poignant was you had this stellar career. You know, you came here as an immigrant with nothing. You had this stellar career and that seemed limitless. And, you know, you were looking forward to a promotion that you had earned. And all that was taken away from you. And the only thing that surprised me about your writing was, you know, my experience in Washington tells me, as I have a high regard for the military and it's an extraordinary organization. It's also a highly political organization. You have to be to survive in that town.
Very
and
true.
They play it as well as anyone.
Yes.
So I was surprised that you were surprised.
Well, I mean, you know, I had developed close relationships and I would have expected at least some of my former seniors to reach out and say, hey, you did the right thing. I mean, everybody just kept their head down. I think to me, what was shocking is that there's a difference between the institution and institutional values and the leadership that actually doesn't in a lot of ways exemplify those values. And I think that's kind of borne out in cost with regards to Afghanistan and the fact that you had seniors, you know, for the past 20 years talk about how the country was improving and insisting that we continue to maintain our mission. But it was at odds with the facts, and if it served any interest, frankly, it served their own personal interest of having a successful tenure in their position. That's the part that my own views on the military leadership is that there is probably going to be some sort. I certainly hope and will advocate for a reckoning and an assessment of the lessons learned from their failure to adhere to values in terms of protecting one soldier or and successfully navigating wars or being paraded in front of a Lafayette Park after protests were suppressed. I mean, all these things were hallmarks of a political military that was looking to avoid fallout on senior leadership and sacrificing the institution to a certain extent. That's the way I see it.
Tell me, finally, how you're doing today, how you see your future now.
So, you know, it's interesting. The title of the book, Here It Matters, is actually hopeful, and it should be hopeful to people that read it. I mean, I think, that's the way I wrote it.
Yeah, sure.
The whole idea is basically, being able to navigate a very, very challenging series of events in the best way possible, doing the right thing in the right way, not being a leaker, being using leveraging proper channels in the right way. All those skills that I accumulated over 20 years coming together to really deal with an unprecedented challenge, and on the back end, like I'm doing now, living with the consequences. I could live with the consequences. I mean, am I happy about how things unfolded? No, there were a lot of personal challenges, a lot of challenges to family, but I could end up on the back end. I'm working on a doctorate at Johns Hopkins. I'm at a think tank. I'm consulting. I'm I wrote a number two bestseller, should be number one, because we know the number one book was a work of fiction, Mark Levin's American Marxism, but you know, it is what it is.
Well, maybe it'll be number one after we finish this podcast. You never know. So.
Sure.
One thing that's very clear from this book is how important family is to you. And when you returned from Iraq, you got married, and you and your wife, Rachel, tried to start a family. She had a couple of miscarriages. And then you had a child who was born, a daughter named Sarah, who lived just a few hours. You now have another daughter, Eleanor, who's obviously the apple of your eye. But how did those losses affect you? How did you experience them?
You know, it's interesting. I think I've been blessed by perspective in certain regards. It's the perspective of what's important. It's the perspective of the fact that, you know, there were bigger challenges that I faced that included losing a daughter, that included, you know, living in an authoritarian regime as a U.S. diplomat and hearing about my family's family's history for my dad, you know, before I was born. I had that perspective. I had the perspective of serving in Iraq. I had the perspective of, you know, living in South Korea and understanding, you know, how just a few kilometers away, life was very, very different. And for me, it informed a couple of different things. It informed my willingness to take personal risks to keep this country different, to make this a place where right matters. It also informed me to maintain a level of positivity that I think is hard to come by nowadays in the United States. The fact that this country is unique, the country is different, the people in this country are, you know, amazing, wonderful people by and large, with the current focal point being, you know, on the divisive voices. So being blessed by perspective has allowed me to make the kinds of decisions I have, to recognize that it's not about preserving my own skin, preserving my career. It's about providing a better future for my daughter, being able to look her in the eyes and, you know, not have to equivocate on actions I've taken. I guess that's one of the overarching lessons, is that we need to sometimes take a step back from what's right in front of us and have a little bit of a broader perspective.
Well, let me just say that your daughter, Ellie, will be able to say of you what you say of your own father, which is you've taught her lessons that will serve her well, and she can be very proud of you. Colonel Vindman, it's good to see you. I wish you the best of luck. I look forward to spending more time with you down the road.
Definitely. It was a great conversation, and we'll make it a point to try to get together at some point in the future.
Absolutely. Be well.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Allison Siegel. The show is also produced by Miriam Finder Annenberg, Jeff Fox, and Hannah Grace McDonald. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Rafina Ahmad, Courtney Coop, Ashley Lusk, and Megan Marcus. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.